This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com. There you can also listen to live shows and to our past shows on iPod Ready Archives. www.thepeoplespeakradio.com. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. It is a pleasure tonight to have a personal acquaintance of mine. And if I can find all of the bio, here we go. How are you? It is wonderful to have you on the show tonight, Scott. Scott Anderson is a nationally certified motorcycle safety instructor. He's an honor graduate of the Motorcycle Mechanics Institute, a former U.S. Marine, and member of the motorcycling community for 42 years. Born the fourth of five children in a middle-class family in the Detroit suburbs, Scott started on two wheels at the age of five, mini bikes to dirt bikes to street bikes, and not unlike many motorcyclists today. Over time, Scott has seen the good, the bad, and the ugly that motorcycling has to offer. Scott is a recovering cross-addicted alcoholic that has been straight and sober for 23 years, an active member in his community, and I can vouch for that. He now teaches people how to safely enjoy motorcycling. He's also very active in the community, working with the Community Coalition to help young people learn positive alternatives to the lifestyle that once consumed his own life. Welcome to the People Speak, Scott.
Thanks, Basma. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure. Scott and I met actually at a recent local chamber meeting. And I have to tell this story because this is the story that I told Scott that night. I have a soft spot in my heart for bikers. Now go figure. There you go. That's my true life admission. When I was young, my father owned a business down in Detroit, and it was, and right across the street from my father's business was the Penetrators Motorcycle Club. Now, for all intents and purposes, and I do use this, Scott, as a disclaimer, the Penetrators were probably not the nicest, law-abiding citizen kind of bikers that you wanted to see, but for some reason, they loved my dad. And,
there was a territory thing going on there.
There was. There was definitely a territorial thing happening. And I remember one day somebody in business threatened my father because he asked him to leave, or I believe he asked him to leave because he caught him stealing or something like that. And the guy threatened my father. And the Penetrators caught wind of it, and they literally surrounded in formation his business. So, that was always very important to me, you know, as a young child, to see a bunch of men, grown men, come and protect a neighborhood business. I always, that really was a very, very powerful image for me.
Well, the motorcycling community, to a large extent, in many ways, is an extended family for a lot of people. And it's viewed that way, and it tends to draw those types of people together. In a lot of areas, the Penetrators were a local motorcycle club in Detroit, and not very well known, kind of under the radar. They weren't like the Huns or Devil's Disciples from Brightmoor. You know, they were a smaller club.
Mm-hmm.
So, but not unusual for a motorcycle club to do something like that.
Yeah, and I realized that, and it was very, as I said, it was a very powerful image, and I was there a lot of times when they would come in groups of three or four or five, and they would be shooting each other with water pistols and, you know, really just having a good old time. So here's this kid behind the counter watching her father conduct business, and, you know, these big, burly, tough guys with leather jackets and leather pants came in, and they were just a bunch of kids having a good time. And for the most part, I think that was how most things are. But there is another side to that. Now, let me ask you, Scott, you know, obviously this thing about the good, you know, we have that coin phrase where we use the good, the bad, and the ugly. What was, now we know some of the good about it, and of course we'll talk about that. What were some of the bad, things about motorcycling, and the uglier things about motorcycling?
Well, I think the bad obviously is, you know, if you watch the news over the last couple of years and, seen a lot of the indictments that have come down for, clubs such as the Outlaws, for money laundering, drug trafficking, you know, those types of criminal enterprises, you know, a lot of drug use, a lot of alcoholism, and it tends to, you know, it tends to draw that type of element, you know, and that obviously is the bad and, you know, as well as the ugly, you know, and again, you're talking about prostitution, you know, those types of things. Also, too, is a lot of, a lot of the risk taking that comes with that, you know, that environment, you know, speeding, you know, reckless behavior on, you know, on a vehicle, and, you know, a lot of the sport bikes that you see out on the roads today, a lot of the younger kids, a lot of the extreme stunts that you see happening out on the road today. So that's what's meant to me anyway by the bad and the ugly. In terms of motorcycling, and it does
and
reflect
has,
on the motorcycling
community.
Has it
increased? Do you think that the violence and the type of corruption that exists within some of the motorcycle gangs today has increased or decreased, or is this just par for the course? I understand that recently there has been a great coming together of some of the in a more organized sense of crime than it ever was before.
That's true. You know, a lot of the guys, and it's like anything else, it evolves over time. You know, you had, of course, back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of those individuals that came together to form, you know, whether it was going back, you know, into the 40s with the Hells Angels or, you know, into the 60s and, you know, later on with Outlaws or Devil's Disciples, the Huns, those types of gangs. You know, it was a lot of former veterans that were coming together that just didn't want to conform to society and were really unorganized in the way that they went about. And things evolve. And as money becomes, you know, plays a bigger role, then, you know, people see the potential in that lifestyle, so then they start to figure out ways to become more organized, more involved in other things, and sure, it's going to evolve, and in that way, it's going to get worse. I can't say from a numbers standpoint that it's necessarily worse than what it was, but certainly from an organizational standpoint, yeah, I definitely believe it's a lot more complex, a lot more complicated and than what it used to be, for sure.
You know, one of the things that I find very interesting is that it seems that as time progresses and as time goes on, the biker, you know, you would think that would be a theme, but there is such a split, I think, right now going on. I know there are many biker groups that are out there that I have personal friends that are bikers. One of the girls that I grew up with, her and her husband, and her sister and her husband, they have Harleys. They love their bikes. They go to the annual events throughout the country. They travel to them. They have a wonderful time. And I think that what I'm seeing is a split. we're seeing that, you know, there's the good, the bad, and the there's the bad and the ugly, and then there's the good and the normal and the friendly bikers that just want to have a great time riding their bikes, and they like the whole persona of the bike riding in their clothing, in the way they present themselves. And you think that's working out really well? Do you think they're creating that new positive image of biking for the communities now?
Well, I think motorcycling is obviously become a lot more mainstream than what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, you go back into the heyday, you know, or the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. If you were a motorcyclist, or if you were a quote unquote biker, you were kind of on the fringe of society, whereas
mm-hmm.
now it's become acceptable in the mainstream to ride a motorcycle. You have, you know, doctors, lawyers, you have people from all walks of life that ride motorcycles now that didn't used to, because it simply wasn't acceptable back then. So
mm-hmm.
I think that has changed, you know, and it's kind of a, you know, an inside joke with a friend of mine and I. You know, if more than two people ride together now, they have to have a patch on their vest. You know, they have to be a club or a gang. So, you know,
you have to have your own gang.
Yeah, there's four of us, you know, so we could be a club, and we could get our own patch and put it on our vest, and we could be really cool. But there is that persona that comes along with motorcycling now that, you know, people, the baby boomers out there that are, you know, 30, 40, you know, 50 years old, we kind of romanticized those, you know, those outlaws back in the day. It's almost like a 20th century cowboy. And you know, we romanticized that when we were younger. And now that we're older and we have some spendable cash, we can get a motorcycle, our kids are grown, and we don't have all the obligations that we had when we were younger. Now we can, you know, we can live that lifestyle. You know, we can buy $2,500 worth of leather, and we can go out and buy a $16,000 motorcycle, and we can, you know, we can trailer it to the bike rally and, you know, take it off the trailer and stand by it, and we can look really cool. And that's what you're seeing a lot of today, and that's great. That's fantastic if that's what you want to do. You know, and then you still have, you know, your dyed-in-the-wool, you know, true motorcyclists that, you know, we ride because we want to ride. We ride because we've always ridden, and because that's what we want to do. And it's no more than just, it's no different for us to go out and hop on a motorcycle than it is for anyone else to go out and hop in their car. It's just the way we get around.
Do you think that, I know you had mentioned, first of all, you are ex-Marine.
Correct.
And do you, and, you know, being a veteran, do you feel that, you know, you did mention that a lot of the vets didn't want to conform. There was a time when they came together. Do you
mm-hmm.
think that what happened during the war impacted that kind of, and influenced that kind of lifestyle?
I think for the most part, any time that you live in an environment that's filled with adrenaline, that's filled with culture shock, that's filled with, you know, any of those things that cause you to change internally.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're taken out of that environment, I think it's natural to look for something that's going to give you a little bit of that back. And yeah, I think that is probably why a lot of people were drawn to that lifestyle, for sure. I know myself. You know, you always look for those things that are going to challenge you, and you always look for those things that are going to give you something back in that way. So yeah, I think that's quite common, for sure.
Kind of the rush of the whole thing. Let me ask you.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have a son that's in the military. Does he ride?
Actually, he's planning on buying his own motorcycle, thank God, when he gets out in 9 months. Right now he's saving his ducats, so he can buy that. But he was raised around motorcycles. Was a range aide for me when I was teaching classes before he joined the military. So he's very, very into motorcycles, very intrigued by motorcycles. So I hope that answered your question.
And, of course, since you teach motorcycle safety, I'm sure that you've taught them all the ins and outs of being safe on the motorcycles.
Yeah, and there's also that element of being the preacher's son.
Exactly.
The wildest kid in the neighborhood, you know, and hopefully that doesn't happen. And he's a pretty conscientious kid. He's a pretty smart kid. I don't really see that as being an issue going forward.
Well, good. I wish him many years of safe driving and riding. Obviously we have to touch on the issues of the bikes themselves. What's your favorite bike?
My favorite bike is one that has two wheels and an engine.
that's
sure,
a good answer.
I get excited when I see a scooter, you know.
All right, then, which brings me to my next one. What do you think about the new crotch rockets that are out? Now, I am not a fan of these things. They scare the bejesus out of me every time one of them goes by me on the expressway.
Here's my opinion on the sport bikes. Great technology, absolutely, positively, state-of-the-art, cutting-edge technology, phenomenal machines. And just can do amazing things. It's not the machine that creates the problem. It's the fact that you have the people that are being drawn typically to the modern day sport bikes are the same people back in our generation that were being drawn to the Harley Davidsons.
Really?
Younger people that are looking for excitement, that are looking for something different, are looking to make their generation's mark. You know, they are, the sport bikes of today are the 21st century version of the Harley Davidson back in the 1960s and 70s.
So they're the extreme portion of the bike, the motorbike industry.
Correct. And,
that's,
you know,
cool.
they can do so many things. You know, they're so fast. You're talking about a motorcycle that, you know, that can do 150 plus miles an hour out of the box, you know, when you buy it.
Wow.
You don't have to do anything to it, and it's already race ready, you know. So, and you're getting a lot of the people that choose to ride those motorcycles are, you know, 18, 19, 20, 24, 25 year olds that really don't have a lot of experience on motorcycles. And consequently, when you take an extreme machine like that coupled with a lack of experience,
mm-hmm.
then that power becomes enticing, and you just don't have the skill level to be able to master that power. And,
so that certainly is
and
a concern for you, especially if you're dealing with safety concerns.
Correct, and it really does. I see more and more younger people coming through the class, so that they can get their motorcycle endorsement on their license, so that they can then go out and buy a sport bike. And you talk to a lot of them, and of course, they're in their mind, they want to go get, you know, that Gixxer 1000 or that CBR or that, you know, they want a 1300 cc motorcycle or a 1000 cc motorcycle. And you try to, you know, when you talk to them, you try to convince them that, you know, what's wrong with a 650, or what's wrong with, you know, a 250, or and ride something that's a little closer to your skill level, and
mm-hmm.
you try to convince
mm-hmm.
them of the fact that, look, if you buy a 650 sport bike, there's no way that you would ever be able to ride that to its limit. But in their minds, they think, you know what, I have to have a 1,000. I have to have a 1,000 cc bike, or I have to have a 1,300 cc bike. I want the biggest, fastest, strongest. And there's nowhere on the street that you can ride that bike to its potential. It just can't happen.
And I mean, that must be difficult for you as a person that is trying to empower these kids with safety as a primary requisite for them to have a bike. It must be difficult knowing that some of these kids are just going to go out and do crazy stuff.
Yes and no. It is difficult when you think about it in that context, but at the same time, mm-hmm. it, you know, when you think about it, the kids today are no different than what we were back in our day. I mean, we were looking for a thrill. We were looking for something that was going to give us that feeling. And they're doing the same thing now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the thrill level that they're seeking is, of course, much, much higher, much more intense now than what it was back then. So in that way, it's evolved. But kids now, in my opinion, kids now are the same as what they were back in the day. The difference mm-hmm. is the availability, what's available to them has changed.
I see. That's an interesting perspective. I've never really thought about it that way, but I guess you're right. I don't think that that we've changed too much. And I agree with you. I don't think we've really advanced or progressed, definitely, as a society. I mean, otherwise we still wouldn't be doing war with each other. But here we are with a lot better weapons, a lot better bikes, a lot faster equipment, a lot just a more honed, clean riding, fighting, or whatever machine that we have available to us. That's an interesting perspective. And we have a couple of questions, Scott. One
sure.
from Arnie in Colorado. Arnie asked, does Scott have any advice for a first-time motorcycle purchaser / rider as far as size, brand, and type of motorcycle?
Well, I'll say this, and I tell all my students this, because I get asked this question a lot. What's the best first bike? The best first bike is one that you don't care about. And what I mean by that is it's not a question of if, typically. It's a question of when you drop it. And if you go out and purchase that dream bike that you have, that Ducati Monster $20,000 motorcycle, and you go pick it up and that's your first bike and you get on it and within a week you've already dumped it twice, that bike will never be worth what it was the day you picked it up. So, and there's another part to that too. As a new rider, you don't yet know what type of motorcyclist you are. You don't know what type of a motorcycle fits your body and fits your purpose. So if you go out and you buy, say, a 400cc, just to throw one out there, a 400cc used motorcycle that you can typically find on the internet for anywhere from, $500 to $1,000, $1,500. They're relatively inexpensive in terms of a licensable vehicle that you can use for transportation. Motorcycles are relatively expensive. You go out and you purchase a middle 80s 400 to 500 cc motorcycle, you pay $900 for it, you ride it for a year, and what that does is it helps you learn what type of a motorcyclist you are. I like my hands higher up, or I would like my foot pegs further forward or further back, or I don't like this seat, I wish this seat were a little lower or a little higher. And you ride that bike for a year, you learn what type of motorcyclist you are and what fits your body and your purpose. And then you turn around and you sell that bike, essentially probably for what you paid for it, because there's always a market for used starter bikes out there. And then you're now ready, and then you have the knowledge base to go out and purchase the motorcycle that's going to fit you, your body, and your purpose. So that's my advice as far as first motorcycles.
Well, that's pretty cool. A lot of times people are probably purchasing bikes just like anything else. Based on desire, based on ego, based on, what looks cool. I know even for myself, I'm not likely to go out and buy something that I don't think is absolutely the greatest thing. I think that sometimes we feel that we are getting a value for our money, but in this case, if we're not experienced, how will we know what is valuable to us? That's a very interesting...
Exactly.
Yeah, that's an incredible way of thinking about it. Thank you. Lewis in Arkansas. Oh, I'm sorry. Go right ahead, Scott.
No. I was done.
Okay. Lewis in Arkansas would like to ask, what is the gas mileage consumption of a motorcycle compared to a car, miles per gallon?
Well, depends, obviously depends on the size of the motorcycle. The motorcycle that I currently ride is a 2002 Harley-Davidson Lowrider FXDL. It's an 88-inch or 1,450cc motorcycle. It's got a big engine on it. Not the biggest, but 1,450 cubic centimeters of displacement, so it's not a small engine. And I usually run between 45 and 48 miles to the gallon.
Now this is actually one of my questions that I was going to ask you, and it's interesting that Lewis asked. Do you think that bikes are going to become a more popular form of transportation, considering all of the gasoline prices? And have you seen any increase in bike sales because of the gas prices?
Well, I think that the effect on motorcycle sales is twofold. Number one, it obviously for economic reasons, but number two, for viability when it comes to metropolitan areas in terms of transportation. All you have to do is look at Europe and look at their situation in terms of the scooters and the motorcycling industry in European countries. You know, you go over there and the scooter market in particular in Europe is huge, absolutely huge, and it is growing here in the United States. I know at one point, it was a couple of years ago, over a two-year period, motorcycles here in the United States had increased by, it was 45 or 48%, and of that 45 to 48%, 75% of those sales were women purchasers. That's the other thing. There was a period of 6 years that motorcycling was the fastest growing pastime among American women between the ages of 18 and 35. So that's a whole other demographic. You know, women are obviously, you know, evolving, becoming more independent. They're less restricted in the things that they feel that they can do, and the things that they're looking to do and enjoy doing. And motorcycling happens to be one of those things. So, I think it's a multifaceted question. In that it's not just economics that affect the motorcycle industry.
I see. We have a question from Mike in California, Scott, and he asks, does Scott know if electric motorcycles are sold in the USA?
There is. Last I knew, there was one electric motorcycle. I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head, but there is one electric motorcycle that is sold in the United States. And I'll tell you what, if I'll look for that information, then I'll get it to you, and then you could post that on your, if it's possible, you could post it on your website.
Well, that sounds great. That's wonderful. That would be interesting. I mean, I know just recently I was watching the majority of the documentary was filmed here, and it was called Who Killed the Electric Car? And I wonder if they have the same feelings about the electric motorcycles. You know, scooters are used all over the world. What's the, for a novice, somebody that knows nothing about this, Scott, scooters and motorcycles, same thing, big engine? Is that what we're talking about here?
There are some differences in terms of a motorcycle. Typically, you're looking at a clutch and gears. So you have a multi-geared vehicle. Scooters typically are a single gear setup. They have a front and a rear brake, no clutch, no gear shift. So those typically are the difference. Other than that, you're talking about, you know, a small displacement engine on a scooter with a small frame. Motorcycles, obviously, you know, they run the gambit. They run from 50 cc's to, you know, very small motorcycles that a five-year-old can ride on up to, you know, just these huge monstrous motorcycles that, you know, three or four people can hop on. So that is the difference, although you are starting to see now larger scooters, upwards of 800 cc's, I believe, that are being produced now, that you can take out on the highway, you can ride cross country. So the scooter industry really hasn't evolved over the last several years. And and again, Asian countries and European countries, the scooter market is just huge, incredibly huge, much more than here in the United States.
Well, that's very interesting. We have another question from Sherry in Missouri. Now, Sherry asks, as a mother of a son who is in high school and who wants a motorcycle to ride to school, can you calm my nerves regarding the safety of him using this as transportation? Chain him to the kitchen table, Sherry. That would be my...
You know what? I can't imagine, just because of my personal experience, I can't imagine breathing and not being able to ride. If I can't ride, then you may as well not allow me to breathe. You know, so my outlook on that is a little bit different. As long as your son is willing to take a safety class, mm-hmm. and as long as he's willing to be reasonable in the way that he rides, obviously there are restrictions. Just really no different than when your teenager gets a car. And most parents will put restrictions on the use of that car for that teenager. And really, a motorcycle can be handled the same. You know, you have to have your safety gear. If you're going to ride, you got to have helmet, proper eye protection. You need to have proper personal protective gear, gloves, jacket, proper boots. And really try to instill in your child the responsibilities that they have from a safety standpoint when it comes to riding a motorcycle.
Can I ask you, Scott, talk to us about helmet laws and how they vary throughout the country and what your thoughts are on helmet laws.
Well, helmet laws, first off, I'm probably the least politically motivated person in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, earlier you said I'm an old Marine, and you know, by virtue of that fact, I'm not really a political guy. You know, you wind mm-hmm. me up, point me towards the battlefield, and let me go. But as far as the helmet law is concerned, the last count I think was 22 states that had the mandatory helmet law out of 50. So, mm-hmm. And a lot of those states require, you know, they have requirements for, 15 to 19 or 15 to 21, you know, and so there's an age range on the helmet requirements, those types of things. My personal opinion on motorcycle use, I'm not one of those, not one of those tried and true long time Harley riders that, you know, it should be my choice where I'm, you know what? Common sense, as they say, ain't so common. So, and that's why a lot of laws are on the books. People say that they want a choice. They want a choice as to whether or not they can wear their seatbelt or not wear their seatbelt. They want a choice as to whether they can wear a helmet or not wear a helmet. And I think where you draw the line on certain issues when it comes to choice is if that choice affects other people. And if you're a father of two, married, living in suburbia, and you choose not to wear a helmet, and that choice then puts you in a situation where you can no longer now provide for your kids based on a head injury that you sustained having not worn a helmet, you now have created a burden on society by not being able to supply or support your family. So it's a very, very deep issue, and I don't necessarily think that there's one clear-cut answer. I really don't.
I guess it depends. I mean, coming from a mother's perspective, I know my son wanted at one time to ride a motorcycle, and I was dead set against it, and I'll tell you why. We happen to have a friend of mine, her brother, had actually fallen off a ladder and went to a coma. He later on died from the coma. But during the time that she was going to the nursing home where he was being cared for, one of the things, that it was a closed head trauma situation, And she was shocked at the number of young men that, due to motorcycle accidents, had closed head injuries and were in comas. And it was very unnerving to her that she had that, and we had discussed that. So for me, it was like kind of scary. I mean, there was just no, you know, as far as I was concerned, you know, it's like I told him, I said, when you turn 18, you want to do it? I mean, I don't have a whole lot to say about it. You can do it then. But younger than that, you can have a car. You're not going to be driving a motorcycle before you're 18. By the time he was 18, he kind of grew out of it. It was all he could do to pay for his insurance on his car and his car payments. So the thought was more about how am I going to get money this month. So for him, it was kind of a fad type thing. But I can see that your love for it, Scott. I can see, I can see that you have this passion for it, and I think that that's an honorable passion. I think that responsibly everything can be handled well. And, you know, you can't hide your children under, you know, you can't tie them. Sherry, I was just kidding about tying them to the table. You cannot tie them to the table.
No,
I mean, although
the
we would
will
like
come
to.
And take your kid away?
I guess so. You know, I think we would like to be able to protect our children for as long as we can, but the truth is that they can get hurt anywhere, under any circumstances. Even my friend's brother, he was on the third rung of a ladder, fell and went into a coma, was in a coma for 3 years, woke up for 2 days, talked to his family as if nothing had happened, and then died.
Oh, my gosh.
So was it a motorcycle? Was it a ladder? So we will have to keep people off ladders forever and ever. I mean, you know, those kinds of things happen. And I never want anybody to closet their children for fear something might like this might happen. You know, there are risks that happen in life. And I think that just the fact that Scott teaches safety at one of our local colleges here is just, shows you that there are so many. And, you know, there are a lot of bikers that I have talked to since I talked to you, Scott, earlier when we had first decided to do this show. And one of the things that one of the bikers talked to me about was biker churches.
Mm-hmm.
Yay!
Oh,
what's a biker what is a biker church? And I guess they are an organized system of biker churches, and they can actually identify certain people based on their church.
There's a group or a club called HIM, which is Harley's In Ministry, and that's a, you know, it's a club that that lobbies for legislation and you know,
mm-hmm.
they do rides and those types of things, you know, very active group, you know, and again, going back to what I had said before. You know, you get more than just a few people together, and, you know, now you have a club. But and that's how a lot of the stuff started. You had people that, you know, that for lack of a better term, you know, live the other side of the motorcycling lifestyle or the biker lifestyle, if you will, and,
mm-hmm.
stopped drinking, stopped boozing, stopped living that wild side of that life, but didn't want to get away from the motorcycling. That they still wanted to hang on to that as a part of their life. So obviously the best way to do that for them was to take, you know, a lot of them were born again Christians, you know, had found religion, had found, you know, whatever it was, a higher power. So they incorporated that into their motorcycling lifestyle. And that's where a lot of that stuff came from.
Well, I think it's wonderful, and it kind of goes in line with some of your work at the Coalition. How are you guys working at the Coalition? Is this, obviously this isn't just about motorcycles. Your life entails a lot of interesting things, and working with, I know Sue Nichols at the Coalition. I know you spent some time at Maxwell's. We were actually going to have, and I'm not going to get off the show without actually putting a plug in for Maxwell Arts and Treasures in Garden City, Michigan. We were actually going to do this show live there, but due to unforeseen circumstances with my husband, we were not able to do the show. But Maxwell was a great friend of ours, offered us the facility. And it's for anybody that's in the Garden City area, please stop by Maxwell's Arts and Treasures. They have Blues and Muse Nights. And Willie had actually set up a whole stage for us to do the show. Unfortunately, we weren't able to make use of it. But I want to thank them for doing the work for us and for allowing us the space. They're good friends of the community. And I know that you, Sue Nichols, a good friend of both Scott's and myself here at the Coalition in Garden City, work with people, drug addictions, work with people that have been that are addicted to many other to substance and substance abuse problems. How do you play a part in all of that, Scott?
Actually, right now, I work as a volunteer for the Coalition, and it took a few months for me to try to, you know, to kind of find my place or to find my niche, in the Coalition. And currently I'm working on a project. It's a 10K run for awareness.
Wonderful.
The way that started was, We were trying to find a way to engage the youth in the community, so that they would start to participate and really become an active part of the community. Because Garden City is not unlike a lot of middle class cities across the United States, and that mm-hmm. there's quite a large divide between the youths and the adults in the community, and there just doesn't seem to be events or occurrences, happenings in the community that create a common ground for people, for generations to come together. So the one idea that I came up with was a 10K run for awareness, and what that is it's a run for awareness, overall health awareness, breast cancer awareness, prostate cancer awareness, child obesity, type 2 diabetes, and also, you know, of course, the prevention message as it applies to alcohol and substance abuse. And it's going to be, currently it's going to be a one-day event. Our target date right now is September 11th. And,
wonderful.
We're planning the way that the concept is, I approached Garden City High School and really wanted to get the kids at the high school level involved. So the way that this is going to work is the kids at the high school are going to do all the planning. I've broken the event down into six different departments, and each department has a youth manager, and that youth manager is responsible for the functions, the daily operations of that department, getting all of the things done, whether it's marketing and, you know, advertising, marketing, sponsorship, vendors, whatever it happens to be, whatever responsibilities that department has, that high school youth is responsible for that department, and they will plan everything. And then each department has an adult advisor as a resource in order to be able to steer the kids in the right direction. You know, if that child hits a dead end, they don't know which way to go, they don't know what to do, they can contact their advisor can put them on the right track, and so that they can accomplish their goals. And then we're looking for this to be an annual event, and to raise health awareness in the community, but then also, as I said, to be able to find a way to engage the youth and get them to participate in the community.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I know when we first started our show, the actual show itself was to help inspire and to show people in communities that it isn't that difficult to become active in your communities. And that's what we did. We started out by helping, and we still are. And this is part of the reason why I tremendously enjoyed having you on our show this evening, is because we want people to see that everyone can make an impact in their communities, and there are, in fact, people all over the United States that are directly impacting, directly working on areas of awareness, such as you are, and that it's not, you know, sure, there's a lot of work involved in it, Volunteer work is always, but in and of itself, it is a fantastic opportunity for growth. It's a fantastic opportunity for people to come together and work together and see the value in each other and to see the value and to impact our societies in a positive way. So I think that's wonderful. I think it's a great thing that you're doing. I'm very proud to have had you on this show this evening, Scott. And if there is any way that we can help, you know where I'm at.
Absolutely.
You know the address. You can come and we'd love to be able to work with you guys. I love that you are dealing with the high schoolers. I think the kids in the Garden City area are just a wonderful group of kids. I know they're involved in a lot of different areas, especially when it comes to some of like the Realize for Life for the Cancer Society. Garden City Hospital, as a matter of fact, also has. I'm not sure exactly what they're calling it. I talked to Fred over there, and it's I think it's a some kind of a walk that they're going to be doing for promoting health for children. And I think it's just a fantastic thing. I think that the more communities come together like this, the better off we are. So get your motorcycle hats on, folks. Get your walking hats on. And as you can see, even in the area of motorcycle safety, you can help positively impact your society and your hometown. Scott, I know you have. I know you're very well respected in the community, and a lot of people like you. And
thank
I just
you. I
happen to be
that.
One of the gang.
Well, and as you know, I'm just a guy.
Well, that's all we all are in the end. I think we're all just guys and gals, and we do what we can do. And I want to thank you for being on the show this evening, Scott. Next week's guest, ladies and gentlemen, will be Yusuf Barakat. Yusuf is also a friend of mine, and he was one of the participants in the recent event, one of the people that was actually allowed into the Gaza Strip. And I'm looking forward to talking to him about what's going on then. Thank you very much, and have a great night, everybody.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief of that summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.